This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. July 1st marks the 25th anniversary of the day the Major League Baseball Players Association became a legitimate union. It was the day Marvin Miller became the executive director of the Players Association. Miller came from the Steelworkers Union, where he was the chief economist and assistant to the president. Miller has written a new memoir about his 16 years with the Players Association called A Whole Different Ballgame. In Studs Terkel's introduction to the book, he calls Miller perhaps the most effective union organizer since John L. Lewis. During Miller's tenure, baseball did away with the reserve clause, an agreement among the owners that bound a player to one organization for the life of his career unless his employer elected to trade or sell him. Now at a point in each player's career, he becomes a free agent, able to sell his services to the highest bidder. Miller was also central to the enormous rise in player salaries. In 1966, the combined salaries of all major leaguers totaled $9.5 million. Today, 22% of the players make more than $1 million. I asked Miller why he went from the Steelworkers Union to baseball.
I had worked in the labor movement for a long time, and I had been familiar with exploitation. But I really had never seen a group of employees so exploited as major league players. And it just seemed to me that, frankly, it was one of those situations where you couldn't fail because almost anything you did had to be an improvement.
Did anybody else in labor see baseball players as part of the labor movement?
I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I recall at the time some reporters on another subject just throwing in a question to George Meany, who was then the president of the AFL-CIO, asking if he thought the ballplayers needed a union. And he knew nothing about what I was doing. And off the cuff, he said, no, that's the last thing they need. They're independent contractors, and they're not workers, and so on. Of course, he was wrong. They're not independent contractors. They've always been employees.
Now, you said you'd never seen a group as exploited as the baseball players. What was your first reaction when you actually saw the players' contracts?
Well, it wasn't so much looking at their contract as realizing the context in which this whole thing operated. It may be that baseball fans today don't quite remember what the reserve rules were and meant. In baseball at that time, and for the prior 80 or 90 years, the system was as follows. A typical entrance into professional baseball was a player being drafted out of high school, literally being drafted by a major league organization. A young man, usually age 17 or 18, signed his first professional contract, and once he did that, he was property. He was owned by the organization for the rest of his natural career, unless the organization decided to try to sell him for cash to another organization, or to sell him for another player, a so-called trade, or release him because they no longer felt he had ability to play. The player himself had no options for the rest of his career. And what that meant, of course, is really two things, basically. One, when you have no options, you have no bargaining power. It means that whether your name is John Smith or Joe DiMaggio, when the club owner says, these are your terms, and if you don't like it, you may not use your skills anywhere in the world in playing baseball. With that kind of a system, obviously there's no bargaining power. But more than that, and really the most offensive part of this, was that when an employer owns an employee, there is no dignity in the workplace. There is no dignified relationship. You do what you're told, I realize that the term slave, which has crept into this through the years, is an exaggerated one in the sense that you can always leave, but you cannot leave and find a way to use your skills, and so you are the next thing to a slave. And that is the most undignified relationship imaginable.
When you got the position mm-hmm. as the head of the Players Association, you say there was a campaign against you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even some of the players were saying things like pro sports has no place for
right.
unions.
Right.
Why do you think there was such resistance to you?
Well, the owner's resistance is obvious. They controlled things and had for close to a century. And They were not about to give up a good thing with interference from a union or anybody else. And so their opposition is understandable. The players, it has to be understood, were relatively inexperienced people in terms of a work relationship. That is, players are very young and in general do not have other prior work experiences. Therefore, they had no connection with unions or any real knowledge about them. Additionally, they and their predecessors for decades had been fed a lot of mythology by the owners. The owners had told the players that this was not an industry, it was a sport. They had been told that the owners don't make any money, that they are all in it because they're sportsmen. The players had been told that they are the luckiest people on the face of the earth to be allowed to wear a baseball uniform. And the players were told that this horrible system of the reserve rules was necessary because if you amended them in any way, baseball would collapse. And so you had, with these young men, an understandable fear of change.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marvin Miller, and he was the executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association from 1966 to 83. He's written a book about that called A Whole Different Ballgame. You say you think there was a smear campaign against you when you became head of the association.
Uh-huh.
Well, what kind of campaign?
Well, you have to understand what happened. The player reps, that is an elected player rep from each of the then 20 clubs, nominated me for the job, but made it subject to a vote by all the players, coaches, trainers, and managers. And so I said, fine, but I would like an opportunity to meet with all of them before they voted. And so in the spring of 66, I made my lonely way through 20 spring training camps, meeting with all the players and coaches and trainers and managers and talking with them. Well, it didn't take long to realize that the owners apparently had been just absolutely panicked at the idea that someone with a trade union background was going to come in here. And so I found, going from camp to camp, that the owners had put on a campaign, because everywhere players would come to me after a meeting and say words to the effect, well, you know, you were not what we expected. You're very different. And I would say, what do you mean? And, well, we were told that, I don't know, you know, you're probably a gangster and you're going to come in here and not be able to speak English and these, thems, and those, and you're going to be 6'4" with a big black cigar and a bodyguard, and you're nothing like that. And so there really was an organized campaign going on, and the problem for the owners was that they overdid it. And as soon as I met with the players, they realized that they had been had, and I won that vote, that election vote, by a 489 to 136 margin.
What were some of the things that you did early on to try to win the players over?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think basically just one simple word really does describe it: education. I felt that it was extremely important to get the players to understand reality rather than the mythology that they had been fed. And so I began really a methodical program of education collecting facts for them to get them to understand the way things really were. I had an advantage which I used in every possible way. When I was with the Steelworkers Union, that's a major union, obviously, with 1.25 million members. And if you set out to meet all the members and to talk with them periodically, I think you'd have to live to be 300 years old to do that. And I realized that when I began with the ballplayers in 1966, that it was a tiny organization. There were only 20 teams at the time, which meant a major league roster totaling 500 players. And I soon realized that was manageable. I could meet with those players. I could meet with all of them several times a year. I could meet with many of them on a one-on-one basis. I used that small size of the organization to personalize the relationship and to use every opportunity to deal with their questions and to present facts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marvin Miller, the executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association from 1966 to 83. He's written a new book called A Whole Different Ballgame, The Sport and Business of Baseball. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Marvin Miller is my guest, the former head of the Major League Baseball Players Association and author of the new book, A Whole Different Ballgame. Salaries soared after players became free agents, and some people say it's really hurt the sport, that players have become spoiled and out of control. Fans make such a small percentage of what the players get that the fans are alienated, and some people say the salaries threaten the health of the sport. What effect do you think the high salaries have had?
I think the impact altogether has been the most marvelous thing for Major League Baseball, that marvelous thing imaginable. Everybody has prospered. I think you have to understand that those people who talk about, they're worried about the future. I worry about the future of industries that are declining. I worry about the future of the basic steel industry, where it's about half the size it used to be. I worry about the future of the automobile industry in this country, laying off thousands of workers and closing plants because they can't compete. And here in baseball, they set record profits year after year after year. It's an expanding industry. People clamor to get an expansion franchise. The whole notion that something bad has happened to baseball is absurd. Part of the problem, and I think this is rather important to understand, is that the way this is covered in the media, salaries are a glamorous subject. And so it gets a lot of ink, and the salaries have grown tremendously. What not one fan in 1,000 knows is that when I came into Major League Baseball in 1966, the total gross revenue of all the teams combined was less than $50 million. That's 5-0. Last year, it was $1,500,000,000. So, you know, these poor owners that we get the crying towel out for, nobody seems to write about the fact that it is these players who have drawn the attraction and the gate receipts and the television revenue, which has produced this annual revenue of $1.5 billion when it was once $50 million just 25 years ago.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marvin Miller. He was the executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association from 66 to 83, and he's written a new book about that called A Whole Different Ballgame. In your book, you're very critical of baseball commissioners. You see them as basically spokespersons for management. Why?
Mm-hmm. Well, because that's their job. Everything else is mythology, and it's important to understand that from the beginning, commissioner of baseball, forget the title, whoever invented that was a genius, because it gave people the idea that a commissioner of baseball was different from chairman of the board of a corporation when it isn't. Commissioners are hired by the owners. Whatever authority they have is given to them by the owners. Commissioners are paid only by the owners, and they are terminated one after the other, fired is a more frank word, by the owners. They are there to be the owner's representative, period. Everything else you have read or heard or have a perception about is completely false.
What were your impressions of Bart Giamatti, who died shortly after becoming the commissioner of baseball?
Well, you know, based on a few experiences, and as briefly as I can, I think Mr. Giamatti, if there had been a post known as a poet laureate of baseball, I think that he might have filled that appropriately. But as an administrator, as a league president, as commissioner, I think he was a total failure.
Why?
Well, he didn't seem to understand the nature of ruling on disputed, difficult matters. I think, without getting into a lot of detail, I think the Pete Rose situation was one of the most typical, in which it is just so unthinkable that someone in Mr. Giamatti's position, with his background in education, would not understand the failure to give due process to somebody accused of breaking a rule. A man who would presume that he could be impartial and a judge in a hearing when, before the hearing, he had decided in writing that the sole important witness against Pete Rose, a convicted felon, was telling the truth when he, Mr. Giamatti, had never met the felon, and when the said convicted felon had not even yet been cross-examined by Mr. Rose or his attorney. And so the man who was going to insist that he be the impartial judge in the Rose hearing had already decided the guilt of Mr. Rose on the basis of unchallenged testimony of a convicted felon, unchallenged because nobody had an opportunity to challenge it yet.
Do you think the punishment didn't fit the crime?
I also think the punishment didn't fit the crime. I think that gambling, as we know it, is against the rule. It obviously required some discipline. Pete Rose admitted to gambling on other sports. And so without getting into the baseball thing, which Giamatti agreed, he had made no finding that Rose bet on baseball. To then say that punishment is banishment for life is absurd. We have had examples in the past. Leo DeRoche's gambling when he was a manager, like Pete Rose, made Pete Rose's gambling look like small-time stuff. And when the authority against Leo DeRoche was wielded, lo and behold, he got a one-year suspension. And I submit that measured against that, penalty of Rose is both unfair and smacks of being vindictive.
You've been accused, when you were head of the Players Association, of taking the adversary position too far, and of not being concerned enough about the health of the overall game. This was mostly owners who were saying that. But I'd like to hear your response to it.
Well, first, the response is that baseball today is so infinitely more healthy and wealthy than when I came in. As for the adversarial thing, I plead guilty. And I explained that to the players from the beginning, there were those players who did not quite understand that the union-management relationship is an adversarial relationship, that it's not a cozy country club where everybody gets in bed together. That's dangerous. And as a matter of fact, I used to illustrate the point by saying to players, I don't go out seeking conflict, but I want to give you a word of warning. If you find that the owners are praising me to the skies, you better look into it.
July 1st, I believe, marks the 25th anniversary of the date that you became head of the Players Association?
Yes, it is, in effect, the anniversary, really, of the organization. Because while an organization did exist before that, that did mark the beginning of the union as a real union, as an independent, undominated organization.
As we near this 25th anniversary, I'm wondering if you were still the head of the Players Association, what things would you want to be doing for the players now?
Well, it's a little hard to say. I talk with Don Fear, the current executive director, from time to time, and if I'm asked to help, I do. But I don't have any official capacity, and I'm not acquainted with day-to-day things. I'm not trying to duck the question, but what I know is this, that they've created in the last negotiations, 1990, a joint study committee to look at some of the economic problems that either exist or that owners fear will exist in a few years. And my feeling is that it's important to be, for both sides to be realistic. Too often, when an industry starts pleading poverty, when it's false, when that isn't true, it just loses its credibility, so that if someday it becomes true, it's like the boy who cried wolf. If he does it falsely many times, nobody's going to come and rescue him when the wolf comes to eat him. And my advice to the industry is to stop that nonsense about poverty in an industry that is setting records every year in terms of their gross revenue. And not only that, every segment of that gross revenue seems to set a new record every year, whether it's gate receipts or income from concessions or from licensing or from national television or local or cable television. each segment of their revenue rises to a new record every year. And in the face of that, they ought to sit down and work out a good relationship with the players, because that's the time when you can do it. It's an industry that faces an automobile industry or a steel industry facing economic disaster. That's when trouble starts, because when you have to start cutting costs and laying people off and trying to cut wages, you can't build a decent relationship in that climate. But baseball should take advantage of the fact and stop crying when it has nothing to cry about, and it ought to build a better relationship while those profits are tremendous.
Well, Marvin Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I've enjoyed very much talking with you.
Marvin Miller is the author of the new book, A Whole Different Ball Game, and it's about his experiences as the executive director of the Baseball Players Association from 1966 to 1983. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.